There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series, Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host and husband, Kyler K. Jafari.
Hi, hi, hi.
Hi, I'm all tangled up over here today. This cord is in between my legs.
Oh, I didn't know you were into that.
I didn't realize I was either, but I guess this is my kink. How are you? Happy New Year.
Merry New Year.
Yes.
Same as the old year.
First episode.
Stays crazy.
2021. Yeah, there's been a lot going on in the world. Do you have anything to say about it?
I mean, I don't have anything to say that everybody else hasn't already said. So, I mean, why dwell on, you know, how crazy everything is?
Yeah, our holidays were pretty boring. It was just the two of us, no family, no friends really, just hanging out and cooking and, you know, drinking. Today, we're just having a little bit of kava. We're keeping it very
simple. The house sparkling.
Mm-hmm. Always a classic.
Well, you know, like Alexis, we always have something sparkling in the refrigerator, ready to go at any moment.
Yes, on the chill. But yeah, we didn't do any traveling. We're in California, so we're super duper locked down here. But you did.
At least the weather's nice.
You did tell me an interesting travel story that I had never heard of before, and I was completely scandalized.
Well, I mean, this is...
You want to share with the class?
This is how bad, like, the wanderlust gets when you've been locked up for almost a year now, I guess, that you even think fondly back to moments like this. So I don't know if there was like a conspiracy on this particular flight to sell people headphones or what it was, but the ones that I had wouldn't fit the jack and I refused to pay $5 for headphones. Well, I'll just watch something with closed captions.
You'll pay $40 for a bottle of champagne, but you won't pay $5 for headphones.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's money well spent. You pick your spots, you know. I'm not going to die on the hill for, you know, $5 earphones. So... Yeah, I was like, I'll watch something with some closed captions. I'll make it work. This is only a 3-hour flight, you know. Almost nothing had closed captions that I was interested in watching. And I always, like, I don't know, you know, plane fare is already kind of basic. So I tend to gravitate to what's the most outlandish thing here that I can watch. Like something that's a little unusual.
Always a nonconformist.
Well, the most unusual thing I could find was The Prince of Tides. And I'm like, oh, I kind of remember this sort of. I never watched it, but
I don't think I've ever seen it.
I just knew that Bubba Streisand is in it and I think Nick Nolte or something. So, you know, I put this on and I'm just like being a psychotic. I'm like watching this without closed captions. But, you know, there's so much schmacting going on. Like you can pretty much piece together what's happening, especially on the part of Barbara Streisand, who I guess directed this as well.
That was her directorial debut.
I mean, I don't know. I think they ran her out of town after this movie. I'm not sure, but anyway.
You mean into her basement?
Yeah. Right. her cellar. So there's like this scene in the third act. I guess this is like the pivotal moment because it's that thing where Nick Nolte is going to therapy or something.
And she's the therapist.
You know what? I found a quote about this film like while we were setting up the soundstage. I'll just read this. The good but slightly barfy tale of Nick Nolte coming to grips with his feelings and deciding to bed his sister's therapist. So that's basically what this movie's about, right? But then you get to like the third act. You know how therapy, like you spend years and thousands of dollars to finally give up that golden nugget to your therapist? Like, I don't know why it takes forever, but finally, I guess he has this pivotal moment with Barbara Streisand, aka his psychoanalyst. And it's this really horrific flashback to 12-year-old Nick Nolte and his abusive family. And I guess the dad did a bad business deal or something. And these two deliverance type dudes show up and like shoot up the dining table. And there's like child, we'll just say molestation. It is very graphic. And
I had no idea.
I was like, what? What? It's like, I was just here to watch Nick Nolte and Barbara Streisand.
I thought
like,
it was a love story.
Lick the scenery, you know? Like, yeah. So I'm so scandalized. And then I look over and this lady sitting in the seat next to me is probably more scandalized. And I was like, well, I made my bed. I guess I'll finish this movie, but she must think I'm a complete maniac.
Now, did she think you were psychotic because you were watching that film or watching that film without any headphones on?
Both of those. And also because there's this insane thing happening on the screen next to her. I mean, you know, people are on planes. They're not there for pivotal psychotherapeutic moments that involve graphic, you know,
sexual assault. I know I always get really worried when I'm watching a movie on the plane or when I used to take planes and there'd be like a sex scene or something because like everybody can see what you're watching. It's so exhibitionist.
I feel like I just self-judge myself because, you know, one time I watched Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, like, because again, it was like this one random
classic
thing.
Porno.
You know, it wasn't like, you know, last year's blockbuster that I'd already seen 12 times. I had to think like, what do these people think about this weird guy watching Gentlemen Prefer Blondes?
Well,
in
kudos
row 23?
To whatever airline that was for having.
Well, I mean, that's my thing. I feel like I have to reward them by watching that stuff because then they'll never put anything interesting in the catalog. You know?
Yeah. So speaking of blondes, we have the return of one of our favorite Dynasty blondes, Sammy Jo Carrington. She's back and bitchier than ever. Let's take a break and we'll get into this week's episode, The Downstairs Bride. Today's installment of Dynasty As They Want to Be is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our darlings a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast. That's N-A-S-T-Y, Nasty Podcast. There you can browse their unrivaled selection of audio programs. Just go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast or text Nasty Podcast to 500-500 to get started today. Welcome back. Where do you want to start? This was kind of a weird episode because the whole Sammy Jo New York stuff is actually just a little minor part of it. It really is about Kirby and then this hostile takeover that's still a brewing between Denver Carrington and Colby Co.
Frankly, this was kind of a snoozy episode. There wasn't, I mean, there was stuff happening kind of, but none of it was particularly exciting.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot.
There's
to
no high drama.
Sink your teeth in the
yeah.
Well, we do start back in Reno with the new couple, husband and wife, Jeff Colby and Kirby, I guess, now Colby.
I wasn't even paying attention to them. All I could see was this wackadoodle hotel room they were in.
I know. Well, that's what I was getting to because I love that you got to see more of the hotel room. I don't even know how to describe it.
I guess this is what was considered middle-of-the-road taste in
was
the early 80s.
Was it supposed
80s?
To be a themed room or was it like leftover from the 70s?
Because it's definitely had a leftover from the 70s, but mildly updated kind of vibe. That's what I was getting.
Well, because like Reno, I think of Reno now and I think that it's kind of like lost its luster, but I would think in the 80s it would be nice, but this room makes it look like it's a dumpster fire.
I don't know if it's a dumpster fire, but I would definitely put most of the things in it in a dumpster and set
be
it on fire.
Be careful, though, because most of those things look very flammable, especially the lampshade that still has the plastic on it.
I love the lampshade that still has the plastic on it.
Now, I remember being a youth in the 80s and going over to people's houses or grandmother's houses or whatever, and there would be plastic on the lampshade. Now, was that to protect it, or they just didn't take it off?
So that was it was left up to the customer if he or she would wish to remove the plastic.
Never leave it up to the customer.
But yes, they came that way, and you could choose to leave it on so that you would never have to dust your lampshades. Or at least if you did, you could actually get the dust off.
So it's like plastic on the furniture.
Mm-hmm, right.
Wild.
You know, instead of you having a dirty, dusty lampshade, you have a lampshade covered in plastic that looks just as ugly, but in a different way. But the lamp that I was into was that insane floor lamp. What was that? And it was like planted right there in front of the window, so it was like a focal point.
That was from the Dr. Seuss collection.
It was
collection.
Definitely like, yeah, the Grinch like stole a floor lamp.
And gave it to you for Christmas. Bah humbug.
And as if that weird Seussical shape wasn't enough, like then it's also got like crystal on it. I don't know. It was kind of one of those things you feel like you see at that really nice quote unquote antique furniture store at the flea market, but it's all just stuff from China that looks like antiques. I don't know. This is very specific, but I feel like Michael Jackson would have picked it out.
Oh, yeah. He would have loved that. Well, as to be expected, nobody is excited about the nuptials between Jeff and Kirby.
I don't even think Jeff
and
Kirby are that excited about it.
I think they regretted it instantly on the plane back home.
It's a great example of how Jeff and Kirby are kind of small fish in a big pond or something. I don't know. I don't know what crappy metaphor I'm going for, but neither of them really has like too much say in their place in the stories or in the universe of Dynasty. You know, them getting married is like, it seems like a good idea to them, but then they realize it's not going to take with the outside world, right? Like, because they don't really have any political sway.
Well, he's doing it as a rebound because he just needs to be with somebody since Fallon has clearly moved on, and she just wants to be a rich bitch and move upstairs.
Well, kind of, but not in the same way that Trampy Joe wants to be a rich bitch. So,
well, that's I feel kind of bad
for Kirby, because which is like weird because I usually just don't even care about her character, but she really does get kind of raked over the coals over this marriage between all of the men, well, most of the men.
Well, it starts with Fallon, although I
thought that's true. Fallon, yeah, Fallon gives her the business too.
But I think Fallon took it way easy on her. I thought Fallon was so level-headed and cool about this whole thing. I thought she was going to be raging, but she makes a couple of quips when they come home and talks to Jeff about it and says, you know, whatever. Even Mark Jennings tries to console Fallon later in the episode because he thinks maybe she might be bereft about this, but she's like, nah, let's just fuck on this couch.
Yeah, that's Fallon's style. She's not all there for the love and the romance. You know, she just wants a nice screw on the wicker sofa.
But Joseph, man, it's been a while since we've seen him be this bitchy. But man, he like sends all the help out of the kitchen when Kirby comes home.
Oh, he doesn't send them. They already know. Like once he walks in, they like skedaddle.
Yeah, he just gives like a little bit of a side eye and they're like, uh-oh, we need a GTFO.
Which, by the way, like I love this spread on the kitchen counter. It's
what, like Joseph's spread on the kitchen counter? Did you notice he sat his ass up on there?
They weren't thinking about hygiene in these days.
There were vegetables.
Well, there were also pheasants freshly caught from the marsh, I guess. I don't know.
I just noticed those big ass carrots. They look like Bugs Bunny cartoon carrots.
Yeah, they were definitely from the organic section at Whole Foods or something. But yeah, so you know, they stop all the chopping of the vegetables and exit the room.
I have a question for you. From this moment on, what am I supposed to call you? Mrs. Colby? Madam? Your Royal Highness. Don't answer that. As the majordomo of the household, I'll come up with the proper form eventually.
You know, the thing with Joseph is he could be a Blake character, but he's obviously not in that position of power to do it. So whereas Blake kind of gets his tantrums but also has his way, Joseph doesn't, you know. So of course, like, all he can do is sit there and berate his daughter and then leave the room in a tizzy. The thing is Joseph's just mad that Kirby's crapping where they eat. You know, she can go marry into wealthy society somewhere else, but not at home.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. But look, there's only so many characters on the show, so it's kind of hard for me to see outside of the context confines that we're existing in here in the Dynasty universe, it's like, clearly they're going to end up together.
Well, it's hard for them to see outside of the confines. I mean, they can't even afford a set for Kirby and Jeff to move to. Like, so I guess
they can't even afford a wedding. You know, that's what I was thinking about with the beginning of this episode.
You're right.
This is the second time.
They didn't elope because they wanted to elope. They eloped because it was just cheaper to shoot it.
Everybody's, since the first episode, when Crystal and Blake had their somewhat fabulous wedding, we have been deprived of a real, true wedding. Everybody's eloped. Have you noticed that? Alexis and Colby eloped on his deathbed. Steven and Sammy Joe. Jeff and Fallon. Jeff and Kirby. Can we not find the funds here to do a wedding? At least, you know, in the back lot.
I mean, it seems like an easy sell because we all know the budget goes to wardrobe, but I mean, wardrobe's half of a wedding, right? So
give Alexis one scene and take that wardrobe budget from Joan and put on a wedding scene. Come on.
And I thought by now, like, Princess Di showed them all how it's done. So where's my opulent wedding?
Amen.
There.
Amen. The church has spoken. Now, the bulk of the episode really revolves around Steven. You know, he just came home, although now he's going to get back on a jet and go to New York. But Alexis sends Adam over there to try to convince him not to get back with Sammy Joe. She's already given him this information that Blake tried to buy the baby. Adam and Steven are not off on a good foot because Adam is like talking all kinds of shit about his lifestyle. I mean, he's saying it's like a hug and a punch. Like he's saying, oh, I'm accepting of this. But he's really just kind of alluding to, well, you may not have fucked Sammy Joe enough to get her impregnated because you're a gay.
Well, I think there's sort of an expression here of even the writer's reluctance about what are they going to do with Steven's sexuality, which totally gets played out with Heather Locklear in the third act.
And Blake too.
But the other thing, like, don't forget that it kind of starts out with Blake and Alexis sort of striking a business deal that they'll leave Steven out of their squabbles. But then, you know, as soon as Blake leaves the office, Adam walks in and, you know, Alexis and Adam are plotting again.
Oh yeah, you can't trust her.
But what's funny is that Adam actually tells her that he truly likes Steven. So is that a put on as well? Like, is he putting on his own mother?
He's only seen him for 2 seconds at the homecoming.
Yeah, I mean, it's all these levels of like political play, but whether he truly likes Steven and he's telling her that for authentic reasons or not, who knows? But
I think a lot of these characters see Steven as a pawn. They want him in their court. You know, Blake and Crystal want him in their court because they want the baby, because they've basically been raising it as their own, which is weird. And then Alexis and Adam just want him in on their side of the fence because I guess it's just more people to go against Blake, which is, you know, Alexis's ultimate goal. I was really sad. We see a little peek into Steven's room. Looks like they sold off of all of those exotic worldly furnishings that he had when they thought he was dead.
I mean, this is also another trope of the time of high consumption that is so well demonstrated in the 1980s, which is, you know, we redecorate every couple of years.
Welcome home. We bought you a 4-poster bed.
It's always a new look, right?
I was sad because I thought that gave a lot of insight into the character, the way he had decorated his room. But he's also like a father now, so maybe he just wants something a little more sophisticated. Or maybe he's sleeping in another room. You know, there's 45 of them.
I still think it's just a little bit more of like how he's like fake Steven. And, you know, this is just more of how inauthentic this character is now.
Are you accepting of Jack Coleman in the... Oh, wow, that was very declarative.
Well, I mean, I don't think the acting is the problem. I just feel like he's not cast correctly for this character. There was a certain depth to Al Corley's performance that we don't get here.
Yeah, I do like Jack Coleman. Like, I think he's very charismatic when he comes on the screen. But yeah, there is this sort of depth that we're missing. And maybe that just has to do with the fact that we spent, you know, 2 years with Al Corley in the role. And he originated it.
I mean, Al Corley hammed here and there, so I'm not saying his performance was, you know, some sort of Emmy award-winning performance, but there was something there. There was something stirring, you know. It was like still waters on the surface, but it was very deep.
Well, and the character was left in such a state that he has to resolve all of these issues. His relationship with his father. Now he's got this new brother. His relationship with his estranged wife. So you can't really get to know who Jack Coleman is in the role because there's just so much business.
There's a lot of baggage. Yeah, for sure. He's inherited a lot, and I think it's just a big weight.
And there's literal baggage because he carries it off to New York to see Sammy Joe. Now, this is probably where they spent the money. I don't know if that was an existing set or what, but
it probably
Sammy
was.
Joe has got it going on with her multi-level New York pied-à-terre.
You know, does that apartment even feel like it's in New York? I realize not every apartment in New York is like a studio, you know, with a air conditioner unit hanging out the front window, but like this just does, it doesn't, it feels like it's just on a set in Beverly Hills or something. Like this,
well, that's because it's on a set in West Hollywood
or West Hollywood, right?
But yeah, I mean, no, it doesn't really feel like it. But also, you know, she's getting a Carrington subsidy here so she can afford something a little bit nicer. But then she tells that agent or whatever that she's boning to get a cosmetics modeling job that she hasn't even paid the next month's rent. Or maybe she told Steven that. But
so I was just trying to piece together, like, how is she paying for this? Who is she?
I think she,
like,
is.
What is she really doing?
I think she is modeling. I think it's a combination of doing a little bit of light modeling. She's got the Carrington allowance coming in. And then I think, you know, she's a pretty young thing in New York. I think some people are throwing her some bones here and there. So maybe she's getting a discount, you know, free dinner.
I think she might be working for an escort service and hanging out with like power brokers in New York.
Okay. I would believe that too.
But then it's interesting to find out that she's actually sponsored by Blake Carrington and Co. She's taken a check from any direction she can get it, apparently. But that's, you know, that's what this character is. I mean, she's, I will give it to Heather Locklear, she's very good at playing a two-dimensional bitch.
I think that we were talking about Jack Coleman settling into the role. I think she's, the more I see her, the more I like her. I think she was a little bit too cardboardy in the beginning in this, but I think Heather Locklear is really growing into this because there's just these little subtle hints in the way that she looks around, and even in the writing, like, she's always wanting that cash. You notice, like, she keeps saying, like,
well, I like that they do that with her. Like, they really don't try to make her this all-encompassing rounded character. She's pretty much just there to be greedy and say bitchy things to Steven, you know?
Yeah, well, and homophobic too, because he takes her to dinner at his favorite restaurant. Yeah, it seems like part of the reason that she didn't want to be a mommy to little baby Danny was because daddy was a gay, she says.
I would sort of underscore some things about what surfaces as homophobia in this episode. It's very frequently presented in terms of the baby child being raised in a normal family, which I'm not going to sit here and debate like what the parental units should be to raise a child in a normal environment, but it's very clear that very traditional family values are still kind of at play here, because Blake says basically the same thing, and I think even Adam does too. Like, it's always presented in like, we don't have a problem with your lifestyle, but we have a problem with your lifestyle being a family for this child, right?
Sammy Joe, listen to me.
No, you listen to me. I didn't do such a bad job at thinking about Danny's best interests. At least I put him with people who can give him what he needs, including a normal upbringing. You want to do your thing with other guys? Go do it. But if you really give a damn about your son, let him grow up with a straight family. Don't stick him with you for a father.
But what's also more interesting to me is religion never ever comes up in any of this. So this is sort of a little bit of a twist, because like that's typically one of the biggest arguments is, oh, but the Bible says, or, you know, God looks down upon or whatever. You don't really hear any of that ever in this show. It's always presented under the terms of maybe traditional family values, or even more, he will have better chances if we don't raise him in that environment. But it's never really about like religion or ideology. It's more about, and this to me is about the amorality of 80s, you know, thinking and the way that people sort of considered these ideas. Is.
Well, it's interesting that nobody considers that he could be bisexual, because, again, we already knew this, but Steven does tell Adam that he has made love to Sammy Joe, and it's entirely possible that he's the father. So it's not even in the realm, it's not even in anybody's vocabulary here that you could like boys and girls.
Well, and also, not to veer too far from your thought there, but Adam very much presents that in a sense of, oh, I've slept with so many more women than you have.
Yeah, let me tell you,
he's such
bro.
A sleazeball, you know?
Oh, yeah, and he's still being a
because
sleazeball.
Because this is Adam's thing where he, like, you know, is so aggressive and just treats women as something to conquer, which I realize is a very, you know, stereotypical masculine type, especially very popular still during this period.
I mean, he even does it to Kirby, who he now knows got married to Jeff, and he goes and corners her, waits till Jeff leaves. I mean, he did have a little bit of liquid courage with some bourbon or whiskey or something. And he goes in and tells her that, oh, she's still going to be his. It's like...
Yeah, this is where I really feel bad for her chilling. Because he's basically telling her how stupid she is. I think that's even his words.
Dumb. You dumb. Are so dumb, right. Miss Colby.
You are so dumb. You are so dumb, Mrs. Colby. Mrs. Colby. Is that a first?
No. Mr. Carrington, a bellboy in Reno beat you to it.
Don't walk away from me, Kirby.
And I feel really bad for her in that because
you know
she is
what
kind
I
of
see when I
in
look
over
at-
her head. You know.
Oh, totally. You know what I see when I look at Adam when he's acting like that? Young Blake. I feel like that's how Blake acted back in the 30s or 40s or whenever he was Adam's age.
Yeah, but it's the 80s now, so could we tone it down a bit?
Yeah, no, it's revolting. And luckily she says, unhand me, sir. I'm a lady of this house.
I think
how
this is like
you.
Their final confrontation.
Good.
In the sense that maybe they'll have some tiffs later, but... This is the first time where she finally breaks through the wall and pushes him away, and she's no longer like this vulnerable thing to be conquered by Adam.
Well, that's what I would like for that character, is that now that she's married, now that she's the upstairs bride, I would like her to assert some power here over her father, over Adam, over Fallon, all of them. Like, be the boss bitch. You can be, because you know French.
But the fact that she knew French got her in trouble with Adam in the first place. So, I mean, that's... a separate thing, but
zut alors.
But see, okay, so but this is Adam freshly off being wounded by Crystal. So this
love.
Is like, this is like Adam's gauntlet with the ladies in this episode. I, you know, so the Kirby thing, he gets rejected, but he was already fresh off a first rejection with Crystal. Like, and you know, that's an interesting one too, because Crystal's usually just moping around and not really capable
of
much.
Yeah, I don't know why she grew such a spine with Adam. She overheard him talking down to Steve, and even though Gordon Thompson seems much shorter than Jack Coleman, but she was like, in the library now. It's been a long time, I feel like, since we've seen Crystal exert this kind of authority.
And of course, sleazeball Adam writes this all off as hot-tempered ladies. You know, like, God forbid women have any prerogative, you know.
Well, she was being a little dramatic, I have to say.
What I want to know, this was a weird one. I don't know what to make of this. What was with the shaking hand on the glass?
I was going to ask you that. So I read it two different ways.
I did too. I had a couple ways for this too.
Okay, so the first was that, you know, we had the old-timey doctor come and visit several episodes ago and allude to Adam having a drug problem. So I thought maybe it was like setting up a return mm-hmm. to that, like he was having DTs or something.
Yeah.
But then more simplistically, I thought, it's because he was lying, because yeah. Alexis sent
I
him.
Thought it was because he was busted being a sociopath.
Yeah, which is like, really? This guy painted an entire office with poisonous paint. Not once, but twice, maybe three or four times. And he can't lie to Crystal without shaking his bourbon.
Well, you know, again, this is sort of like when, you know, the masculine bullshit gets called. And then suddenly it's cowering in the corner.
100-0.
That's what Crystal's up to here, because he's so used to just... He even tries to write her off when she first says, you know, in the library now. He's like, well, I've got things to do. And she's like, no, that's not going to work this time. You're going to come in the room and we're going to give you the business. But anyway, so yeah, clearly like he's been called out. And so it's interesting to sort of see that masculine shell kind of crumble that way. But yeah, I also kind of just considered, well, maybe it's just like he's got some weird drug problem or the DTs or who knows.
Now we do have a little more of this business takeover going on. It's taking a long time, but Blake, I guess, has really made all of the board members just hang out in other parts of the world so they can't convene.
That old trick.
One of the board members, Dexter, returns from the Bahamas, so it seems like this is going to be concluding soon. I mean, we're almost at the end of the third season, so it's got to go somewhere. But
one thing I like about this is all, there was a little moment earlier in this episode where Alexis is pretty much exposed for, you know, being manipulative by Blake. I forget what the context was, but anyway. And that's sort of the thing about Alexis is she's always guileful, but she always gets caught for it. It's just, and in a way, she doesn't seem to care because ultimately she's just still up to her tricks, you know, it never stops. And I love this thing that the guy lands in the Bahamas and he's being presented with, you know, papers to show up in the boardroom. So she's still like, she's got tricks up her sleeve, even if she gets caught all the time. I don't know. That's kind of this funny duality about her character.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, I don't want her to always get her way. Two steps forward, one step back. I know this episode wasn't like too exciting, but one thing that I was really surprised about and kind of titillated was when Sammy Joe picks up the latest edition of the National Enquirer and she sees that Stephen Carrington is alive, which is Stephen Carrington really that big of a deal that he makes the top of the fold on the National Enquirer?
Well, it is just the National Enquirer.
But then below that, did you see that the cast of Dallas?
Yeah, you spotted that. I didn't even notice that, but because it's like such a blip, but yeah, why would you have the cast of Dallas?
Your biggest competition. That's wild.
But I noticed they put some gaffer's tape over the actual Dallas title on the headline. So
I guess back then, like, people weren't really, like, freeze-framing things and making GIFs out of stuff, so they thought they could just kind of get away with it. Maybe it was a little bit of an in-joke, but yeah, confirmation that Dallas, the TV show, exists in the world of Dynasty.
Well, I mean, this was back in a world before assholes like us had podcasts and, you know, would call it out. But also, is that maybe just like a little bit of a snarky comment on their competition, like that they're on the cover of the Enquirer? I mean, that is like your grocery store tabloid, right? I mean,
yeah, that seems like something Sammy Joe would have a subscription to.
So for all the cheesy lovemaking and saxophone scenes in this show, I think the one in this episode's got to be top 10 worst ever, which is Crystal laid out like a Gilby's gin advert.
In front of the fireplace.
In front of the fire, on the fur carpet, rug, whatever.
Yeah, with a watering can full of martinis. I kind of liked that.
Oh?
What's this? But, you know, what was interesting about that scene is the way that Crystal can exert her power over Blake is only through, like, sex and romance, right? She can't have a rational conversation with him to convince him to talk to Joseph about being a bitch to his daughter for getting married to Jeff Colby. She's got to turn the fire on, get martinis made, put on her sexiest negligee, lay down on the bearskin fur rug or whatever, the mink rug or whatever that rug animal that rug was made
of. It's a scrap of fur that was just lying around. You know,
whatever 90 minks had to die for that rug.
Yeah, I kind of thought the same thing. It's like, as much as Alexis kind of pulls some strings in the background, so does Crystal in her own way, although I think Crystal tends to use her powers for good, not for evil.
Oh, so this was definitely her using it for good because she saw that Kirby was being distressed. So she's trying to help another sister out.
Well, just what every tired businessman needs. A lovely lady on the floor next to a fire, a pitcher full of martinis. The only thing that doesn't go with the picture is, why are you so pensive, darling?
I was just thinking about Jeff and Kirby, and about you.
Oh, how did I get into this?
But it's just comical, the hoops that she has to jump through. I mean, she probably just had the staff do all of that, but
oh,
still.
She didn't stir those martinis herself. Are you kidding?
But other than that, I think Crystal's whole MO on this show now is to keep that baby for herself. And you see it in that last scene when Blake and Steven are having their confrontation in the library over his lifestyle and being a father.
She's like, I'm just going to sneak out of here with the baby.
I know, I love Linda Evans like walks in and goes, whoops. Uh-oh. And does a 180 and walks right out, or she tries to anyway. And then she
Crystal
pulled into the
where
drama.
Where are you going? Where are you taking that baby?
Where are you going with that baby? Yeah, I think she was going to go get in her Rolls and like drive back to Ohio with that baby. She wants it so bad.
We have a low-speed Rolls-Royce chase with the baby.
I just don't get it. Adopt the baby if you want one so bad. That can totally be your own. Aren't there a lot of babies out there in 1983 that want to find new rich homes?
They didn't have
homes?
A budget for any more babies, so they got to make it work.
Well, thank God, because I don't know how many more babies they can fit into that nursery.
Oh my God, that nursery, by the way, it's like the headquarter for all of the gossip. It's which is fitting because, right, the nursery is like where people go to have all these undeveloped childish emotional discussions.
Those babies are going to be so traumatized by all the conversations.
Imagine raising
that they
a
overhear.
Child in this environment.
Those babies have heard all of this drama. The new dynasty should have just been those babies talking about how fucked up their grandparents
are. I mean, is this the
were.
Montessori method, or is why am I so screwed up?
Now it's time for the part of the episode where Kyler and I choose our looks of the week. Well, there were a lot of interesting choices made by the ladies this week, but my favorite, actually, she hasn't been serving us a lot of strong looks lately, but I did like, in the beginning of the episode, Crystal was wearing this kind of black, I think it was like a jumpsuit, and it had like a corset belt with like really cool gold
detail.
It was like a,
I don't know if it was a wrap dress, but it was a dress.
Oh, it was a dress. Yeah. Okay. I don't remember what the bottom looked like because I was looking at the cleavage, because normally, like, as you've noted,
plunging neckline.
Yeah. She doesn't normally plunge that deeply. She's normally covered up like she's an Amish woman, but yeah, she had a really nice plunging neckline. And I just really liked that. That belt corset thing. I thought that was like a cool choice.
And this might be an example of where she's mixing black and brown and it does kind of work. It didn't bother me the way it did the last time she tried that.
But
it was with the super high scrunchy boots. So it's a lot of like head to toe fabrics and textures. And I mean, I don't know, maybe they're just implying winter in Denver, you know, that's probably what that is.
Yeah, but there was a lot of jackets and coats and coverings. But yeah, unfortunately it was all undone because later on she wears that nightmarish white number that's like cut really high with the weird floral embellishment on top of it. And I don't know.
That looked to me like something that lands on the back of Nordstrom Rack or something, like for 70% off.
Nordstrom Rack? You mean Goodwill? Ooh. Kyler, what was your look of the week?
Well, there were definitely some pieces that were like kind of juicy. So I loved the knit jacket that Fallon wears for the first half of the episode.
No,
yeah. I don't like the whole outfit.
This is not how I wanted to start off 2021. How much fabric did it take to make that jacket?
Well, so it has this sort of like large geometric lapel situation going on.
Lapel? That was a quilt.
I also liked that she was wearing this belt in the nursery in her final outfit at the end of the episode. It was a sort of like primary color tiles thing. There's a lot of like
color
statement
blocking.
Belts going on in the show, I've noticed. So that's something I hadn't thought much about. Out of as far as 80s clothing. There was a thing with Alexis that the looks weren't great, but she was doing all of her signature purple in her penthouse. Like I do love this running theme, and I'm sure it's not accidental at this point that, you know, when she's at and she's in her lair, purples and lilacs and
living
violets,
the lavender
and
fantasy.
Yeah, you know, because by the way, like the flowing nightgown is not the best of night attire I've seen on the show, and then the sort of purpley blouse thing that she wore prior, also not a great look.
And well, she did class it up when Steven came home and she wore the nightie with the marabou feathers.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the nightie with the marabou feathers.
Oh, okay.
I mean, which, you know, it's
or
like
were
it's
those chicken
fine
feathers.
But it's not like this big statement. It's always accessorized with champagne or a black cigarette and a crystal table lighter. So, you know, Alexis has other things kind of going on in this episode, but, you know, it's not a lot of, like, super outstanding outfits.
So you just liked the accessories as your look of the week.
Yeah, I think it's definitely about the accessories in this. But, you know, that's kind of fitting because the whole episode was kind of even keel, not super outlandish or exciting. So, you know, whatever. They can't all be grand slams.
Yeah, the episode was an accessory, hopefully to a better outfit next week.
Where's Pamela Bellwood?
Well, that's it for this episode of Dynasty As They Want to Be. Kyler, thank you so much for joining me again.
Always a good time.
And I want to thank Lindsay Mound, the artist who designed our logo, and DJ Jugo for doing our theme song. If you want more from Dynasty As They Want to Be, we have a Patreon. You can support us financially and get access to exclusive bonuses. It's patreon.com/nastypodcast, and follow along on our journey between episodes on social media. We're at Nasty Podcast. That's NASTY podcast. Join us again for the next episode, The Vote.
Let's just say I thought about it. I never got anything else from you, did I?
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.